Members, we will start the Health and Human Services Reform Committee. We don't have a quorum present yet, but we'll begin with presentations and announce when the quorum is present. So the first item on the agenda is we're going to have Scott Leitz come forward to present. If you want to come forward to the table, Mr. Leitz, introduce yourself for the record and who you represent.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Scott Leitz. I'm Assistant Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Human Services. Thank you for the opportunity this afternoon to give you an overview of medical assistance in Minnesota care. I'll do a brief introduction and then turn it over to Ms. Gibson to deal with the bulk of the presentation. But I did want to give you a little bit of background on Medicaid, medical assistance as it's known in Minnesota, and a little bit about Minnesota care, just to give you a little bit of context as it leads into the more detailed discussion that's going to occur. Medicaid is a health program. It's a federal health program split between the federal government and the state government that provides health services for eligible individuals and families with low incomes and low resources. The program is means tested. And it is jointly funded, in this case in Minnesota, 50% federal and 50% state, although it varies by state, by the state and federal governments. Federal law does require that Medicaid programs cover certain categories of individuals and services. Beyond that, states do have some flexibility in the design and implementation of their Medicaid programs. So basically, there's a base of what the federal government requires that states do, and then states have some flexibility beyond that. In Minnesota, we refer to our Medicaid program as the Medical Assistance Program. And then part of the Minnesota Care Program, and Ms. Gibson will get into this, I believe, in more detail, is also part of the Medicaid program, which was authorized under a waiver of the traditional Medicaid rules. In terms of coverage, medical assistance covers preventative and primary health care for low-income families and children, the elderly, and people who are blind or have a disability. It also helps many low-income Minnesotans pay Medicare premiums and copays. Now, just a note of distinction here. We often talk about the Medicaid and Medicare programs. The Medicaid program is the program I'm referring to here, which is a federal and state program for low-income individuals. The Medicare program is for individuals 65 and over. That's the program that many people refer to as the program that you go into after you're retired. It's paid for fully by the federal government with some enrollee premiums and cost sharing. But I want to make that distinction for the committee so you understand those two programs, while sounding alike, are different. Medical assistance also pays for long-term care, such as care for nursing homes and ICFMR. In fact, Medicaid is the nation's largest payer for nursing home care. And so that's an important note. When we look at expenditures for an enrollment in the Medicaid program, about half of the enrollments in Medicaid is children, about a quarter is adults, and about a quarter are the elderly and the disabled. But in terms of expenditures, the vast majority of the expenditures on the program actually go to serve people in nursing homes and for care to people who are elderly or disabled. Medical assistance also pays for home care services that help the elderly and people with disabilities stay in the community, and for home and community-based services through the long-term care waiver program for people who, without those services, would otherwise reside in long-term care facilities. In other words, it's a waivered program that helps people stay in the communities, in the community. Otherwise, they would end up in nursing homes, and Medicaid helps to support people staying in the community in that way. Shall I turn it over to you for this? Mr. Chair, just briefly before I close, the main point that I just wanted to summarize here is that the medical assistance program, while being a program that serves many, many individuals, you see almost 800,000 individuals here, it's important to note again where that enrollment is. More than half of that enrollment is with families and children, but where the expenditures are, which is highly concentrated among the long-term care elderly and disabled nursing home populations. So the program itself, while being around since 1965, has grown and covering additional groups of people, really serves that core group of people.
Mr. Leitz, at some point I know you're going to want to talk a little bit about the population covered by the new early MA expansion, but Do we want to talk about that a little bit before you move on, or?
I can, Mr. Chair. I'd be happy to.
Could you please? Thank you.
I will do my best to wing it, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Gibson will correct me when I misspeak. I'm sure. The federal government under the federal as I noted earlier, there's a number of populations that are covered under medical assistance, and in the federal health reform bill that was passed in March, states were given the option to they'll be required to expand Medicaid coverage for childless adults by 2014 up to the level of 133% of the federal poverty line. Under that bill, states were given the option to expand that coverage more rapidly, to do that expansion to childless adult populations more rapidly. Governor Dayton let the 2000 last year's legislature authorized the governor to take up that option. It provided funding to do that and authorized the governor, whomever it might be, to take up that option at his or her discretion. In January, as part of one of his first acts after becoming governor, Governor Dayton did take the option to expand Medicaid to singles to childless adults up to 75% of the federal poverty line. This is a population that had been previously served by the General Assistance Medical Care Program, or CCDS program, since I believe since June or July of this past year. What we anticipate is that starting in March, which is what the governor's executive order directed the department to begin enrollment into that program on, we would enroll approximately 95,000 people into the medical assistance program under that early enrollment option that the governor opted into. A little bit more than half of those individuals are Minnesota Care enrollees who are currently being served by the Minnesota Care program. They will go into the Medicaid program, medical assistance program. Approximately another 12,000 or so are people who had previously weren't part of our insurance programs, and the remainder would be people who were previously enrolled in the General Assistance Medical Care or CCDS program.
And Mr. Leitz, just to clarify, the medical assistance program, for those not as entirely familiar with it, is a fee-for-service program, correct?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the medical assistance program is administered through both fee-for-service as well as the managed care plans. The enrollment of the early, as being planned now, the enrollment of this population of medical assistance enrollees will be as part of the early enrollment piece would be enrolled in managed care plans under plans as they're currently constructed. There's a period of time, about 45 days, where they would receive where they would be on the fee for service program. During that time period, they make a choice of health plans, and we pay fee for service during that time period, and then they enroll into the health plan of their choice and then are managed through that, their care is managed through that health plan.
Before we continue, we have a question from Representative Huntley.
Just a comment, Mr. Chair. The only 10 states were allowed to do the early enrollment. It was not all the states, just 10, and those were the 10 states that had programs like General Assistance Medical Care or Minnesota Care for adults without children. So it was, from my point of view, it was one of the few times we were ever rewarded for being good instead of being punished for being good.
Duly noted, I would agree. Please continue. If you'd like to introduce yourself to the committee and then continue with your presentation. Representative Quam has a question in the meantime.
Mr. Chair, I understand the 10 states. How many states actually are participating at this time of those 10?
Representative Quam, that question could probably be directed to Mr. Leitz. Mr. Leitz, do you have an answer to that?
Mr. Chair and Representative, it's our understanding that we would be the second state in addition to the District of Columbia, I believe, that would be opting into that option.
Okay, please proceed with the presentation. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Karen Gibson. I'm the Director of the Healthcare Eligibility and Access Division at the Department of Human Services. I will pick up where Mr. Leitz has left off in this presentation. So I'm going to move on to the slide on Minnesota Care. As Mr. Leitz mentioned, Minnesota Care, part of that is considered to be our Medicaid program, the portion that provides coverage for families with kids. We also have a portion of the program that is for adults without children that is fully state funded. Minnesota Care provides basically primary health care coverage for low-income families with children and adults without children. Enrollees typically are working families and individuals who do not have access to affordable coverage, and they do have to pay a premium for Minnesota Care coverage. There are no health condition barriers, but applicants do have to meet income and other program guidelines to qualify. As I mentioned, households do have to pay a premium. Currently, premiums range from a minimum of $4 per person to month up to a maximum of $141 per person per month. And coverage is limited to, I should say, premiums paid are covering up to three people. So the maximum premium for a household is $423 a month. The projected enrollment for the Minnesota Care program, kind of by our two large groups for fiscal year 2012, is 143,000, most of which is with the families with children group. You can see the number there is quite a bit lower on the adults without children. This takes into account that many of the folks are going to be shifted over to the Medicaid program with the early expansion taking place starting at the beginning of March. This slide just provides an income distribution for our Minnesota Care enrollees. This is a little bit dated, but it shows back in fiscal year 2009 the percentage of our folks at various FPG levels, federal poverty guideline levels. The vast majority of these enrollees have income of 175% of federal poverty guidelines or less. I think the committee may have received this next slide or handout previously. It just provides a summary of covered services under our health programs as well as co-pays. Might be a handy sheet to have. As I understood it, the committee was interested in getting into some discussion about the federal poverty levels, income limits for the programs, which is where I'm going to hopefully take us to. But to start, I wanted to start with the different groups of people that are covered. So in order to be eligible for MA or Minnesota Care.
Ms. Gibson, if I could interrupt you just for a moment. I noticed that Representative Fritz is very interested in moving the minutes. We have a quorum now, so we're going to take care of that real quickly. I apologize for the interruption, but Representative Fritz, you want to move the minutes? Very good. And members, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Very good. Thank you. Ms. Gibson, please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In order to be eligible for MA or Minnesota Care, an individual must be a member of a group for which the eligibility is either required by federal regulation or state law. In general, there are six categories of federally mandated individuals: children, pregnant women, low-income parents, the elderly, individuals who are blind, and individuals who are disabled. As was mentioned earlier, the adults without children under age 21, at least on the Medicaid side, is a new optional group, but will become mandatory in January 2014. Eligibility requirements for Medicaid, for medical assistance in Minnesota Care, such as income limit, income method, and asset limits, vary depending upon which group an individual is a member of. This slide just shows the different MA and Minnesota Care groups that we have, compares and contrasts them. For the most part, we have the same groups of people on both programs, with the exception of elderly, blind, and disabled, typically are not eligible for Minnesota Care because they have Medicare, which for our programs constitutes other health care coverage. If they would not have Medicare, it's possible that they could qualify for Minnesota Care in one of the other existing groups.
Ms. Gibson, if I could ask real quick, we have federal dollars, obviously a federal state match on medical assistance. Under Minnesota Care, we also pull down some federal dollars, I believe, for the children, correct?
Correct. That is correct. We do receive federal match. We also receive federal match for parents as well. We're going to get to a slide in a little bit. I think that'll show that. I'll try and describe as succinctly as I can our income methodologies for MA and Minnesota Care. They do get a little complicated. I know you've heard people talk before about the complexities of our programs, and they are fairly complex. For MA, income eligibility is determined separately for each member of the household. We use the client's net income to determine eligibility, and we are usually looking at what we refer to as a six-month budget period. So we're looking at and trying to project income for a six-month period. In order to calculate the income, we first are looking at the household composition. Each individual, since we're looking at eligibility individually, we determine the household size. And on the surface, it would seem like if everybody is all together related, the household size should be the same for everybody, but that is not always the case. For example, unmarried parents that live together with their mutual child, the household would be for each adult, for each of the parents, is a household of two, themselves and the child. But again, for the child, it would be a household size of three. So it's a little bit different there, can be a little bit tricky. So once the household size is determined for the individual, you also have to determine whose income counts for that individual. In the case of children, not parents' income is counted towards determining a child's eligibility, and a spouse's income is counted in determining the eligibility of their spouse. So we are looking at whose income is counted after the household size is determined. After that, we're looking at what earned income do you have in terms of wages? Do you have any unearned income, for example, unemployment benefits? Are you self-employed? All of those are looked at, calculated to determine, what is your income. From there, we will determine if there's any income that is excluded or unavailable, in which case it would be subtracted from the gross income. Some examples of income that would not be counted would be tax credits, rebates, or refunds are not counted as income, so if those were received, those would be deducted. And unavailable income might be income that the client is not able to access. That also is not counted, so it would be deducted. After that, we further reduce that income by any applicable disregards and deductions that might apply to the client. Those disregards and deductions vary based on which group an individual fits into. So there are different disregards for each group. Some are time limited, some have no time limit. So they do vary.
Ms. Gibson, could you give a couple of examples? I mean, I know
certainly
don't want to go through the whole list, but
right. For example, an earned income deduction, if somebody is elderly or disabled, the first $65 of monthly income is disregarded and one half of the remainder. And that's not a time-limited deduction. That's any time they're working. That only applies to those individuals. It wouldn't apply to parents who work or others. So as an example. After the disregards are taken into account, you will arrive at a net income figure. The net income figure is then compared to the appropriate income limit and family size to determine if the person is income eligible for the program. If their income does not exceed the income limit, if it's equal to or below, they are eligible. If it exceeds the income limit, they may be eligible on what's called a spend down basis, where they may have medical bills sufficient to the amount of income they're above the standard and may qualify by essentially spending down with those hospital bills to meet the income limit. Just as a note, individuals that require long-term care services, a different income calculation is used to determine how much income they have to contribute towards their cost of care. Moving on from that, I'm going to go into the Minnesota Care income method. Minnesota Care, unlike MA, where we were using determining eligibility by individual, for Minnesota Care, we look at household income in determining eligibility and use a gross household income as opposed to the net individual income that we were using in MA. That income eligibility will determine, besides just if they're income eligible, also what their premium amount will be. We start with a similar step in that we determine who is part of the Minnesota Care household, again, based on marital and parental relationships. But everybody that's living together that meets those relationships are counted. So unlike in the MA case where unmarried parents wouldn't count towards each other's as a household, in Minnesota Care, they are part of the household, and they would be all considered together. We then gather information about all of the income that the household members have, again, looking at earned income, unearned income, and self-employment income. We do deduct, as we do with MA, excluded or unavailable income. From that, then you will arrive at the household's gross annual income. You will note, unlike MA, there are no deductions or disregards applied. You know, there's no earned income disregards or deductions for child care expenses so parents can work. That doesn't apply to Minnesota Care. So if the household's income is at or below the income standard, the household would be eligible for Minnesota Care. If it exceeds the income standard, they would not be eligible for Minnesota Care.
Ms. Gibson, the original upper limit for Minnesota Care when it was originally approved in the early 90s was 150% of FPG, correct?
Mr. Chair, you know, I would have to go, I'm sorry, I wasn't here at this time. I might have to go back to the annals of history. It started out as a children's health care program. That sounds like it could be correct, but we certainly can follow up if you would like that.
I think that was the case. All right, thank you.
Okay. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, this next slide illustrates the income limits for MA and Minnesota Care by our groups. The second column has the MA income limits. The third column has the Minnesota Care income limits. Under MA, we start with our children under age 2 have an income limit of 280% of federal poverty guidelines. Pregnant women, 275. Children ages 2 through 18, 150% of federal poverty. And from there on down, for the most part, our income standard, our income limit is 100% of federal poverty guidelines. The Minnesota Care income limit for most groups is 275% of federal poverty guidelines, except for parents whose income is the lesser of 270% of federal poverty guidelines, or $50,000 annual income, and adults without children, where it's 250%. So the numbers are a little deceiving because the income methodologies are quite different. So although the income limits are lower, there are more deductions available on the MA side. I think the next slide will show what those income limits are for these figures, at least to a household of 4. So you get a sense of what the annual income limits are. Those limits are adjusted each July based on the Health and Human Service Poverty Guidelines that are published in the Federal Register. So again, this July we would be updating them. They are going to increase slightly. This chart, and I believe you've got a full-size scale of the chart. It's a little hard to see here on this slide, I think. Highlights by broad populations at the top of the chart with the black banding, the white lettering, kind of our three large populations by program, the various FPG levels that we have, and for the different populations. It also tries to illustrate, although it's a little tricky, you know, because of the shading that we're using here on this, to identify where we get federal financial participation or federal match and how much that we are getting. So for families and kids, most of that under MA and Minnesota Care, we're getting 50 or higher percent federal matching. Our family planning program, we get 90% federal match. Our adults without children under GAMC and Minnesota Care, so those are fully state-funded programs. And under age blind and disabled, essentially we're getting the 50% or we're getting a slightly enhanced federal match at this time because of a temporary increase in federal match under ARRA. So anyhow, we do have a Medicare savings program, the QI or Qualifying Individuals Program, where we get 100% match. Um, a last chart, which I know can be a little mind-boggling. This is a chart primarily, I think, designed for workers use this as a tool when they're determining eligibility. Specifies in greater detail our monthly and annual income limits by our
Gibson, just a moment.
Programs.
Representative Barrett, did you have a question on the previous slide? Could we jump back and take Representative Barrett's question? Very good. Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Chair. Just have a quick question about the family planning to 200% dotted line area. How much, what is the cost of that to our state, the MA cubed, I guess?
Ms. Gibson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't have that figure here, but we certainly can provide that to you. I don't have a forecast line, but we can certainly
Thank
provide
you.
That.
Representative Barrett? Okay. Very good. Please continue, Ms. Gibson. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The income and asset guideline sheet provides by our programs in different populations, the different FPG levels, and kind of breaks it down by family size, going quite a ways down to family size 10 and additional members beyond that for monthly and annual income limits. It also at the very bottom includes the asset tests, you know, what the asset limit is for those groups. And, Mr. Chair, unless there were questions on my portion of the presentation, I will.
Members, any questions? By the way, I would encourage that that slide that was just before this one is one you may want to keep if you don't want to keep the whole packet, but I would keep that in your saved folder. It's a great reference as we're talking about these various programs and reforms and changes to seeing where we're currently at. Representative Barrett has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Gibson, I want to go back to slide four, if I could.
Slide four?
Four, yes. On slide four, we talk about long-term care, both in terms of in-facility care and then home care services. Do you know what the cost is for each of these two programs and possibly the amount of patients that we serve? And then what would the qualifications be? Could a person choose which level of care they would like to belong to, or is that proposed to them, or could you explain that type of thought process regarding which care is appropriate for which individual?
Mr. Chair, Representative,
Ms. Gibson.
I don't have the cost or person served information here, but we can include that with the family planning as follow-up to the committee. I'm not an expert in the long-term care pieces in terms of level of care, but my understanding is that there is a health assessment that's conducted by either like a county case manager, a public health nurse. There might be others that can conduct the assessment that make the determination of what would be the appropriate level of care based on the person's, you know, medical needs, activities of daily living, etc. I'm certainly happy to provide some additional information if it would be helpful on that as well.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Great. Members, any other questions for Ms. Gibson? Yes. I'm sorry, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Representative Lohmer.
Thank you. I want to go back to the question on the family planning, but I'd like to have an explanation of what it is, the family planning program demonstration project. Can you give me any more information on what is that program? I'm not familiar with it. Thank you.
Right. Mr. Chair, Representative, the family planning program provides preventative services to individuals ages 15 to 50 whose income does not exceed 200% of federal poverty guidelines. The purpose of it is to prevent pregnancy. I know previously there have been questions about does it cover abortions, and it does not cover abortions. It's intended to try and prevent pregnancy as a mechanism by which we can help prevent other expenses on the Health and Human Services programs that could occur from an unintended pregnancy, such as a young woman who maybe finds herself pregnant and not in the ability at an age where they could support someone and may needing coverage from our MFIP program or something like that. So it's intended to prevent that.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question in regards to the federal poverty guidelines. It's a chart here. this one. Okay. And on the bottom, there's a little bullet note that says, if income exceeds the limit, may spend down to 75% federal poverty guideline to qualify for MA. How if income exceeds the limit, how do you spend down? I'm just not quite sure how that works.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the spend down is actually a Medicaid option that our state has selected. It's kind of like a group sort of onto itself. You could think of it that way. So if someone exceeds the standard limit that would apply to them as a member of the group, in this case, somebody who maybe is disabled, my income is above 100% of federal poverty, so I'm not going to qualify under that basis. They still can qualify if they would have medical expenses equal to the amount of the income that's in excess of the income standard, so that they can still get coverage.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, thank you. So when you're talking about the spend down, what I'm hearing you saying is that if they have medical expenses, that's a subtraction, thereby their income would be below that. Is that a fair way to say it, too?
Ms. Gibson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, not exactly. Actually, that part, the amount of medical bills that they're over the income standard by, they are responsible to cover for themselves. Eligibility isn't established until essentially they've spent down on those medical bills to the income standard. It's sort of similar. You could think of it like similar to an insurance deductible, maybe a easy way to think of it, or easier way to think of it. So if the income standard was, for example, $100 a month, but my income was $150, I wouldn't be eligible. But if I had $50 in medical bills that I covered myself, I would be responsible to pay them myself. Coverage could kick in after that point for me.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Okay. Members, any other questions? We've got plenty of time today, so don't be shy. All right, Ms. Gibson, if you'll hang around, too, just in case there are additional questions, we'll bring up Ms. Berg. Thank you for your testimony. Ms. Berg, welcome to the committee. If you could state your name and position for the record and then proceed with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Ann Berg. I manage the Federal Relations Unit within the Office of the Medicaid Director at the Department of Human Services. And I was asked specifically today to talk about the maintenance of effort requirements in the Affordable Care Act. What I've done here on the first slide is to basically paraphrase what's in the Affordable Care Act, because it's perfectly unreadable in the statute itself because of all the cross-references. Essentially, what it is saying is between enactment in March 2010 and when the exchange is up and running in 2014, State Medicaid programs are not allowed to have eligibility standards, methodologies, or procedures that are more restrictive than what we had in effect in the date of enactment, March of 2010. In terms of what we have to maintain, they're including both the regular program eligibility standards and any standards, methodologies, or procedures that a state may have in a Medicaid-funded waiver program like Minnesota Care. The penalty for violating the maintenance of effort requirement is FFP in potentially the entire FFP, sorry, federal financial participation, federal matching funds in the entire program. There is an exception in this requirement if a state has a current deficit after January of 2011 or is projecting one for the following fiscal year, and we certify that to the Secretary of Health and Human Services, we can have an exemption from the maintenance of effort requirement for adults above 133% of federal poverty if for those adults who are not pregnant or disabled. The next slide.
So, Ms. Berg, if I'm not mistaken, if Minnesota were to come into that time period projecting a deficit, it would be within the state's option. Not saying we would, but the option would be to discontinue coverage for adults above 133%, correct?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Thank you.
The next slide.
Representative Huntley, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair and Ms. Berg, we cannot adjust eligibility, but we can have things that are in our benefit package that may or not, that are not required by federal law. Could we change those? I'm thinking specifically of dental benefits. Not that I would ever want to get rid of dental benefits, but we don't have to offer those, is my understanding. But we do.
Ms. Berg.
Mr. Chair, Representative Huntley, that's correct. It's an eligibility maintenance of effort requirement. It would not prevent a state from altering, reducing, eliminating optional benefits in the Medicaid program.
Representative Huntley?
That's fine.
Okay, very good. Representative Abler.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. The dates for that that waiver thing weren't on that slide. Did you say for 2011? If there's a deficit projected for 2011, then we could ask for a flexibility on enrollment. It seems like we're predicting a deficit for that time. And so are we going to ask for that flexibility? Just so it's one more tool in our toolbox, or is that a decision that legislature makes, or is that a decision that the administration makes, or the department, or how's that going to go, do you think?
Ms. Berg.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, yes, the date is January of 2011. We're assuming we're currently eligible to ask for that certification, and my understanding is that the commissioner of MMB, the governor's office, are aware of that issue.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler.
Do you think they plan to ask for it?
Ms. Berg.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, I don't know the answer to that.
Oh, do you think you could, Mr. Chair?
Representative Abler.
Do you think you could ask what their position is going to be? Thanks.
Thank you. Ms. Berg, I'd be interested in the answer to that, too.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Kiffmeyer, and then we have Representative Murphy, and then Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Those were my thoughts as well, well put by Chairman Abler. I think the question I have is also not just that eligibility area, but also our benefits set, Representative Huntley, as you said. There are certain things, matter of fact, I think if I recall right, every option possible has been included in Minnesota, but there are only certain ones required by federal. Do you have a list of the what is required by federal to be included?
Ms. Berg.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't have the list with me now, but we can certainly provide that to the committee.
Thank you. That'd be good for us all.
Okay, I have Representative Murphy, Representative Liebling, and Representative Loeffler. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Berg. I just wanted a follow-up question on the benefits issue, not subject to the MOE. Are there benefits not subject to the MOE in addition to dental?
Ms. Berg.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, in general, optional, the MOE applies to eligibility rules, methodologies, procedures, and standards, and it doesn't apply to optional benefits. There is some interaction that has yet to be clarified by CMS. And the interaction largely occurs in the long-term care area. For example, the maintenance of effort standard has been interpreted. This gets complicated. CMS has not yet interpreted officially the maintenance of effort requirement in the Affordable Care Act. What it has done is interpret a similar maintenance of effort requirement in the stimulus bill, the ARA. And if you take that guidance and apply it to the Affordable Care Act and assume that the guidance will be the same, CMS has said under the ARA that states cannot alter their definition of disability, their institutional level of care standard, the number of slots available in home and community-based waivers, for example. Now, what's different about this maintenance of effort requirement is that it's split between adults and children. It ends in 2014 for adults. It extends out into January of 2019 for children. However, the institutional level of care standard, the waivers, the definition of disability is all required by, well, two out of those three things are required to be uniform across the Medicaid program for adults and children. So it creates a lot of question, especially in the long-term care area, about what a state can and can't do in terms of operating institutional care and home and community-based care between now and 2019.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy, I would just add, members, and a clarification for others who may be watching or listening, my interest, at least, and I hope others, about MOEs and where they apply and where they don't apply for Minnesota is more about flexibility and what options the state legislature and the state of Minnesota has versus what the federal government is going to mandate that we put in place or keep in place along with federal funding. So it's these questions aren't necessarily meant to say we're going to cut things or not do things, but to identify where we have flexibility and where we don't. And Ms. Berg, I'm sure we'll probably want to have you back yet before the end of session to kind of update us as we get more information from the federal government about these MOEs and so forth. Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Berg, I'm just trying to put together this discussion that we're having about being able to cut off people. Basically, if I'm paraphrasing this right, what you brought us from the Affordable Care Act, it basically says you can't dump people off of MA before the exchange is running, except if you have the deficit, projected deficit, and then you can dump off certain people or cut them off. So I guess I would like clarification. I'm trying to put together this over adults with income above 103% of the federal poverty guidelines. So 133% of the federal poverty guidelines. So who would that be? I mean, who would that be that's on our MA program that would be eligible to be cut off if we were to use this safety valve, so to speak? You know, and again, I want to say for the listening audience, just like you, Mr. Chair, I am not advocating that. I'm just asking, who are we talking about here?
Ms. Bergen, you can feel free to throw out a lifeline if you need to. There's somebody else who could help answer that, but Ms. Berg.
I think, Mr. Chair, I think I'm all right here. It's largely going to be the group that would qualify for that exemption is going to be adults in Minnesota care with income above 133.
But, Mr. Chair.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, but, right, adults in Minnesota care. But aren't we talking, maybe I'm missing something here, aren't we talking about medical assistance? When Minnesota care is not federal dollars for the most part, so.
Ms. Berg.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the maintenance of effort applies to the Medicaid program, and there is Medicaid funding in Minnesota care for parents now, and they're for parents.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So are we then talking, so the only people, it seems to me, that would fit this from what I'm understanding here is parents who now are on Minnesota care who presumably will be on medical assistance after we get the early option going? Otherwise, I'm having trouble picturing who we're talking about, if anybody.
Ms. Burt.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we cover parents in Minnesota care with Medicaid funding through the Minnesota Care 1115 waiver for people with income between 0 and 275% of poverty. Adults without children in the early expansion that's going to take place on March 1st are only eligible under state law up to 75% of the poverty. So currently the only federally funded group that's above 133% of poverty and capable of being retracted, if you will, is that group of parents.
Okay. Thank you. That's what I was trying to find out.
And members, I won't use this as an ad for a certain bill, but that's part of why we're offering House File 8. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Berg. I'm just trying to understand how this might apply to the waiver programs, particularly those that serve people with disabilities. Is this primarily focused on health care? Does this apply to the entire range of MA-supported services? So if, for example, we wanted to deal with some of those thousands of people on the waiver waiting lists, would we have to do waiver reforms, amendments, in order to change in any way the way we serve people on the Medicaid waivers?
Ms. Berg.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, that issue is, I think, of great concern for all states because of the maintenance of effort extends into 2014 and to 2019. For children, the question is, in an environment of budget deficits and the need to be more efficient about what we are providing, what is our ability to reform benefits and services using a mix of state plan services and waiver services and avoid violating that maintenance of effort? That part of this requirement has not at all been clarified by CMS at this point. I am being told that guidance will be issued relatively soon.
Thank you.
Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Berg, I don't mean to belabor the point, but regarding the waivers, I'm looking on slide 17, and I think that seems to be a slide that might answer some thoughts on which groups are eligible to be waived. And I think I understand it, but I'd like you to walk me through it if you could. And it's that slide that shows the families and children, adults with children, and age-blind and disabled.
Members, it's headlined, I believe it's the one that's headlined, Federal Poverty Guidelines for Minnesota Healthcare Programs. That's the one that I mentioned you might want to hang on to as a point of reference. It indicates the mix of state and federal dollars by program and income level.
So given the 133% guideline, which of those columns would we have the flexibility to discuss using that waiver option if we so chose to do? Ms. Berg.
Ms. Berg.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we've already discussed the column Minnesota Care Parents.
Okay.
Family planning is a mix of children and adults, and the exemption only applies to adults, so it's probably presumably there would be at least an issue we would have to work through with CMS there. We've already discussed the adults without children population. They're only covered up to 75% in federal funding now, so they're not an issue. And in terms of all of the home and community-based waivers that Minnesota has, five of them, those are all people who are either elderly or disabled. It's not clear to me. It's not clear to me whether the elderly waiver. I can't recall whether a disability is required for that waiver or not. But the other four disability-related waivers. Clearly are not part of that exemption because the waivers are for people with disabilities.
Representative Barrett.
So am I, thank you, Mr. Chair, Ms. Berg. So the Minnesota Care, the column that says Minnesota Care 250%, is it true that that's all state funded, so that's not applicable, correct?
Ms. Berg.
Mr. Chair, Representative, they're all state funded until March 1 when people up to 75% of poverty will be covered in part with Medicaid funding.
Okay. Yeah, Representative Baird, if you look at the GAMC column,
right.
GAMC as we know it as of March 1 is basically gone. It's going to be replaced by this early MA.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair and Ms. Berg, maybe I'm losing my way here, but people on the elderly waivers would be required to be covered on maintenance of effort. Is that correct? So we, what I'm thinking about is, can we reduce PCA hours again?
Ms. Berg,
if we're covered by maintenance of effort, but what if we're in a deficit and we get the option to reduce things?
Ms. Berg.
Mr. Chair, Representative Huntley, I believe I've lost my way as well. but yes, all of those home and community-based waivers are subject to the maintenance of effort requirement. PCA is a service that exists both in the state plan and within the home and community-based waivers. That's an optional benefit, and cutting PCA wouldn't necessarily violate the maintenance of effort requirement. Whether or not the elderly waiver meets the exception to the maintenance of effort requirement for people above 133, I'm not sure of. I'm guessing they wouldn't, but I have to go back and look, and we'll get back to the committee on that.
Representative Huntley.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think we need to understand that, or at least I need to understand that, and if you have a waiver program, you don't have any PCA, then do you really have a waiver program?
That's a very legitimate question, Representative Huntley. I was going to say, I didn't think you were asking the question to suggest we cut PCA services. Quite the opposite. And members, I'm not surprised. Ms. Berg, it may feel like we're putting you on the spot, and we kind of are, but this is part of what's happening with the ACA as it's coming forward, is there's a lot of rules making going on, and we don't have clear answers to every question, and that's kind of the state of the art right now. But we very much appreciate you coming here and filling us in on what you can tell us for certain. Members, any other questions for Ms. Berg? I'm sure she'll hang around. Otherwise, we are going to bring back, I'm sorry, Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question in the back of my head. From last year, we talked about asset methodologies, and I don't know, was there any legislation that passed around looking at asset methodologies differently? Do you that's a question I'm asking the chair, maybe, or...
Well, members, I know over the last 4 years we increased eligibility requirements, but as far as asset testing under standard state programs, I'm not aware that we have. Mr. Chun, is that something you could shed some light on?
Mr. Chair, Representative Peterson, I guess I don't recall any changes, or at least any major changes the state made regarding how we calculate the asset methodologies. I mean, there's been some discussion when we bring in a new eligibility groups under the federal bill about the federal government requiring, you know, sort of a different asset methodology that the state would need to implement.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Berg, I think you have one more slide. I'm sorry. It may have sounded like I was cutting you off early. Maintenance of effort, I think. Slide 21.
Mr. Chair, what that slide is our summarization of what CMS has told us in various forms of guidance based on the AARA maintenance of effort, which ends in July of 2011. So if you assume these same rules apply to the Affordable Care Act, this is what we know so far. You can't drop eligibility groups, increase premiums, institute asset tests, reduce income standards, those kinds of things.
creates an area of flexibility, if you will. Representative Abler.
Well, thanks, Ms. Berg. Would it be considered a change in eligibility requirements if we discovered that one county just wasn't doing its the same kind of eligibility determinations that some other county was, and we told them to do what they're supposed to do? Or would that be considered continuing current methods?
Ms. Berg.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, I think that states have been assuming to some extent that enforcing your current rules is not going to be a violation of the maintenance of effort requirement.
All right. Actually, I'm kind of, it seems like there's, as I've been having way too many meetings, there's a great flux, great diversity of application of our programming across the state from county to county, and part of the point of having these service delivery authorities was to have some more commonality and cooperation. So that's why I ask. And so if you could just kind of make sure, that would be helpful. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Ms. Berg.
Thank you.
We're going to have Scott Leitz from the Department of Human Services come back up and talk a little bit about the early MA timeline. Mr. Leitz, welcome back to the committee. Do you get battle pay for sitting in front of two of these committees back to back, or?
Not that I'm aware of, Mr.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Scott Leitz, Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Human Services. Mr. Chair, my understanding is you want a little bit more background sort of on some of the timelines and so forth with regards to the early MA. I'll walk through some stuff. Feel free to obviously answer ask questions as they come up. As I mentioned earlier, under the federal reform bill, under the ACA, states will be required to provide coverage up to 133% of poverty for childless adults by the year 2014. Under that same bill, states were given the option to enroll that same population, and that funding will be 100% funded by the federal government, I might add. States were given the option at current matching rates to enroll that population earlier than 2014 at state option. The 2010 legislature did authorize that expansion up to 75% of the federal poverty line. Gave that allocated funding for that, authorized it, and then gave the governor the authority to implement that. In January, by executive order, Governor Dayton did take up that option, and his executive order directed the department to begin implementation of early this expansion, which is oftentimes called the early MA option. By March 1st of 2011, again for single adults up to 75% of poverty. The department has to receive federal approval to do that implementation. We have submitted a state plan amendment to the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services, CMS, and we're actively working with CMS to receive that approval. We've had very good discussions with them. We believe we're coming along well with them. We have yet to receive approval, but are hopeful that we will have approval very soon for that program. Upon implementation...
If I could ask, if we haven't received approval yet and we're supposed to enroll people by March 1, is that somewhat of a concern?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, approval for funding for the program and approval is retroactive to the quarter, to the first day of the quarter that a state plan amendment was submitted. So we submitted in January of this year. If it were to go beyond March, that would not cause us a problem because approval, which we are very, very, very confident of receiving, would go retroactive to the first date, to the date of the first quarter.
Mr. Leitz, let me ask hypothetically, if we didn't get approval, and you said you're very, very confident, but what if we didn't? I'm just playing it out here. Is the state then on the hook for those costs?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll take a shot at answering that question. I might have to ask Ann Berg to come up if I go astray on it. Again, CMS is working very actively with us. The option is in the federal law. It was put forth as an option by Congress. The state is taking up that option and merely working through the details of how that is implemented. In a very hypothetical situation, and I do want to stress, Mr. Chair, it's highly, highly hypothetical, that we would not receive approval, and we had enrollment, we would have to deal with that through the budget process that we would have. Again, Mr. Chair, I want to be very, very clear, though, that the likelihood of that is extraordinarily. We are very, very highly likely to receive that approval. We are very close to receiving that approval from CMS now. We're working through the remaining details, but I have to say that up to this point, we have satisfied every detail that CMS has asked us for. So we believe it's more likely a matter of if, and we believe that if is hopefully going to be before March 1st rather than when.
Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner Leitz, concerning the retroactivity back to January 1st, assuming that goes through, that really does not affect the state budget because all the money that we're going to get for that period will be paid out to providers as increased payments. Is that correct?
Mr. Leitz.
Mr. Chair, Representative Huntley, I'm just going to ask you to clarify your question because I'm not sure I tracked fully on it.
Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner Leitz, we are currently paying for these people that are either on Minnesota Care up to 75% of poverty or people in the GAMC program, CCDS, whatever. We're paying some amount of money out to providers for that group. If we get eligibility for early enrollment in MA, if I understand it right, the feds will pay us retroactively roughly a dollar for every dollar that we have spent on these people, but that money must go to the providers does not end up in the state budget. It goes through the state budget, but it goes out to providers. Is that true? So I'm trying to figure out if we're going to get suddenly a big chunk of money for 3 months that it will fix part of our budget.
Mr. Leitz.
Mr. Chair and Representative Huntley, no, I mean, the effective date for the state plan amendment that we've submitted is March 1st. We would receive, if approval were to go beyond that, which again, we're hopeful it will not, but there is some small possibility that it would. It would be retro to March 1st, and there would be no the money that's been allocated would be there would be no budgetary impact on that.
Representative Huntley.
Well, Mr. Chair and Mr. I thought if we submit this plan during a quarter, that it's retroactive back to the beginning of that quarter, which should be January 1st.
Mr. Leitz.
Mr. Chair, Representative Huntley, I apologize. I was getting some counsel from Federal Relations Director Anberg. But
you get a lifeline too.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Believe me, I need many of them at this point in my tenure here. I'm sorry. Could you repeat that?
Yeah,
Representative Huntley.
If you get apply and get approval, I'm not sure whether those are completely separate or whatnot, but in any given quarter up to the last day of that quarter, that you will get, the state will get reimbursement payments back to the first day of that quarter, which would be January 1st.
Ms. Berg.
Mr. Chair and Representative Huntley, the issue with the early expansion is Minnesota's got expenditures both in the CCDS GAMC program and in Minnesota Care, but CMS has told us definitively that they won't allow FFP for expenditures for adults without children until we have a program in place that includes the full Medicaid benefit set, eliminating the asset test, using all the Medicaid criteria. And for us, we put that in place, or we're putting that in place on March 1st. So they're not willing to provide federal funding back to January 1st.
Nice try. Well, we live in hope, right? I mean, do you want to continue, Mr. Leitz?
I can, Mr. Chair. What on March.
Sorry, just a moment. We have a question from Representative Abler.
Thank you. I'm just helping to play stump the staff, Mr. Chair. Mr. Leitz, I just reading the November forecast. I understand that the effective date of January 1st was there for the expansion, and so that there's money built into that as though it had been effective on January 1st. And so are you familiar with that part of it? Or you can phone a friend, but I think that's true, and I think that we're getting $22 million or something in this biennium and $33 in the next one or something like that. And so with this pushing the date back to February, to March 1st, we're actually going to have a cost with that, even though everybody knew. It was really a funny deal because it would, everybody knew it would not go into effect January 1st. They were thinking October. And so, but for some reason, as some kind of a bargain made with MMB, they decided to put it January 1st because it, anyway, is that true? Do you know what the amount of the buyback is going to be?
Mr. Leitz.
Mr. Chair and Representative Abler, I'll have to get that information for you. I don't.
Yeah, it'd just be a ratio, I think. More bad news. Another $6 million or something.
So we go from hoping we have some money to help us to maybe some money not. We'll wait to have the proper answer from the department. Thank you, Mr. Leitz. You have more to present on this?
Mr. Chair, I think I covered the majority of the remainder earlier, just describing who the populations were and how they would be moving in. So if there's additional things that related to that, I'd be happy to answer, but I think those are the key pieces.
Thank you. I have one question, and that is, as we've moved this up now from October to March, I think the governor decided, you know, October is too long to wait, let's move it up to March. What are some of the things you're having to do to meet that deadline? And I'm specifically referring to, as I understand it, you're going to need to go to paper enrollment process as opposed to electronic, and that's going to mean some cost to the state. So one question is, how is that going to change the enrollment process? And the second is, how are we covering those costs?
Mr. Chair, we, as you mentioned, one of the things that in order to move the date from an October date to a March date, the systems at DHS are not as modernized as I think we would like them to be with regards to enrollment and some of the other things from a computer perspective. So the Minnesota Care population will be hand converted, if you will, over a course of about 6 months into the MA system. That process will be probably the most labor intensive piece of this. You know, as a practical matter, we get a great deal of new initiatives, new things that we have to do each year at the department from laws that are passed or federal changes that occur that require us to prioritize and reprioritize issues on a pretty regular and constant basis. This is another one. This became a top priority for us, and we are prioritizing it thusly. We won't be seeking any funding for any additional funding for this. It's something we'll simply do within our current administrative budget, and we'll reallocate and reprioritize as is necessary to do it.
So help me understand this. The people who are eligible for the early MA under Minnesota Care, although we wanted to get them started March 1st, it's going to take 6 months to get them converted. Help me understand that.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, that population will be eligible March 1st. It will be; they will be enrolled in the Minnesota in the medical assistance program March 1st. What we'll be doing is basically updating their information into the system itself, so that we have them in over that time period.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Leitz. Does that mean that they will be, though, activated in the electronic system right away as far as being designated eligible? So if they're showing up at a pharmacy to fill a prescription, that pharmacist will know right away that they are covered. It's just a matter of updating some other provisions in the background, and so that as far as the provider system is clued in, that will be activated?
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, that's my understanding, yes.
That answered my follow-up, too. Representative Loeffler.
And just a follow-up, in terms of having to do the paper system, just kind of, there's others in the room who understand this better than I do, but I'm wondering why you can't use our existing eligibility system with just dropping the asset provisions on it, or use our current processing system, even if it doesn't have all the same steps. I'm just not quite sure if I'm quite understanding what has to be paper versus what has to be electronic.
Mr. Leitz.
Mr. Chair and Representative Loeffler, I think the main problem issue, and this is just a longstanding issue that I think we'll need to tackle as a department moving forward, is that the eligibility systems that exist within DHS, there's a couple of them, and they aren't necessarily in sync as well as they should be. And so the conversion relates to really to people who are on one system becoming eligible under another system within the department. And so it's not as simple as dropping a piece of a test on one system, but rather moving people from one system that they're currently on into another system. And that's where the conversion occurs.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Leitz, that paper conversion between the programs, that would be the way we would have to do it regardless of the calendar, isn't it? Isn't that it's not a calendar problem, it's a system problem, isn't it?
Mr. Leitz.
Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, the majority of this problem is a system issue here that will, as I mentioned earlier, need to be looked at, and I think we will be looking at that moving forward, hopefully. But yes, I mean, part of it would be given an infinite amount of time, you could probably make the systems talk to each other. But I think given the timeline that we're working under, and even with a somewhat longer timeline, there would still be a systems issue.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Leitz, is there any concern about if we're currently doing electronic and now we got to do paper, and even if we had to do paper anyway over time, is there? I guess I would be a little bit concerned that there might be some discrepancies or the potential for things to drop as you're moving from an electronic to a paper system. Do you have systems in place to make sure that doesn't happen?
Mr. Chair, we do. I can't speak specifically to them, but I know in talking with staff and understanding kind of the process that we're going through, we've built in a number of integrity checks to ensure that occurs. Certainly be happy to provide whatever information we have on that.
Representative Huntley and then Representative Loeffler. Representative Huntley.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman and Commissioner Leitz, I'm just trying to understand. Currently, don't the counties do the eligibility? And how are the counties where these people show up going to interact with the Department of Human Services and the way that you do eligibility?
Ms. Gibson. See, it's a team effort.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. He's a new boss, so we will jump when he says so. Medical assistance eligibility is determined by counties, and we have had county representatives work with department staff in planning for the transition of Minnesota Care clients. A lot of Minnesota Care eligibility is determined at our agency. Our state Minnesota Care Operations Office determines that. So they will be participating in helping those people get over to the MA system. So we are working really closely with counties trying to define a transition plan, which cases make sense, Minnesota Care cases make sense for the counties to move over, which would make sense for our Minnesota Care operations to move over. Some of these folks are on food support or cash assistance programs. So in those cases, it probably will be the counties that will do the transitioning. But if they aren't on, if they're not active in our MAXIS system where our MA eligibility is stored, it'll probably be our Minnesota Care operations staff. So we want to work together, support the counties in this, help the people get over as quickly as they can. So it is tricky, as Mr. Leitz mentioned. Our MA eligibility is in one system, and Minnesota Care eligibility is in a different system. And MMIS and MAXIS don't talk, but it sounds like we will be looking at that issue very soon and working on that. So, but for now, to help people move over. And I should clarify, too, that MA eligibility, even for the Minnesota Care enrollees that are transitioning, will be done in the MAXIS system. So I know we're talking about papers and this and that, but their information will be moved manually. Mm-hmm. So it's, I think, more data entry than we're talking about papers. Moved manually into the Maxis system, entered there so that approval, MA results can be approved and they can have their MA eligibility established for them. So that's kind of what the plan is.
And Ms. Gibson, Mr. Lights, I think that's where I've heard some concerns expressed, is if we're going to do manual entry from one system to the other, there's always the potential for, you know, people's names getting dropped or addresses being incorrect or whatever the data is that's being entered. And I'm sure you're considering that too. I don't see how you change that if we're going to go March 1. Help me understand, you mentioned the cost is going to be absorbed internally at the Department of Human Services. How much are we talking?
Mr. Chair, I think that we, again, it's we haven't put, to my knowledge, a specific number on that. And part of that is because it's part of our constant updating of how we do work planning and how we do our prioritization within the department. And quite literally, it occurs, reprioritization occurs certainly after every legislative session, but then frequently in between sessions as well as new issues come up. So what we strive to do is to do the very best we can to get the work that's in front of us done as rapidly as possible. And new issues do rise from time to time that take priority over others. Part of, as Ms. Gibson mentioned, what allows us to do this work without a complete diversion of resources is the fact that we will be doing that manual conversion over a period of time. And that will help help alleviate some of the crush of the workload up through the March deadline. But I'm not trying to avoid your evade your answer, but it's just a matter of the fact that we simply do that type of prioritization all the time.
If you did have an estimate at some point, I'd be interested in having that information. Good. Members, other questions? Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Gibson. I know you're working with really old systems. I think they were designed in the 70s with a minor update in the 90s. So they're really dealing with bubblegum type programming. But at the same time, I'm hoping that you're reaching out to the Office of the IT Technology Czar, whatever the new name is, in administration, as well as the Department of Revenue. I kind of cringe whenever I hear manual data entry. And I think that there are some systems in other state agencies that you might want to look at whether those are feasible. I know the Department of Revenue, they still get lots of people filling hand forms, and they're electronically scanned and done accurately. And since you'll be able to dump it out, I assume, of one system, and it's a printout, so it actually won't be looking at handwriting. It'll actually be something quite easy to scan and have machine read. There may be some tools that are available in other state agencies that might be more effective, and just because you've been asked to work with decades-old systems doesn't mean you can't look to partners in other parts of state government that have been blessed with something a little more modern.
Mr. Lights? Fair enough, right?
Fine suggestion, Representative. Thank you.
Members, any other questions? Thank you very much for the information. We appreciate it. The entire team. Members, we do not have committee tomorrow. There is another event going on, I think we're all familiar with. I've also included in our packets today a little bit of, I like to stir it up a little bit, and this latest editorial from the Wall Street Journal might be of interest to you regarding the ACA. And members, if there's no other business for the good of the order, we'll call the meeting adjourned.
We're still meeting up at 5:30.
Steve?